Welcome to SCOTUSCast, a project of the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies. Our contributors join us from around the country to bring you expert commentary on U.S. Supreme Court cases as they are argued and the decisions are issued. The Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions are those of the speaker.
Hello, and welcome to SCOTUSCast. I'm your host, Kyle Hammerness, on behalf of the Faculty Division of the Federalist Society. We are here today to discuss SEC versus Jarkissi, which was argued before the court on November 29th, 2023. It is my honor to introduce our guest today, Peggy Little. Peggy is senior counsel at New Civil Liberties Alliance and has over three decades of experience as a trial and appellate litigator, representing individuals and high-profile litigants, including Fortune 50 companies, financial institutions, public companies, and universities in both state and federal courts, including the United States Supreme Court. And with that, I'll hand things over to our guest.
Thank you so much. So I'll start with just a little background, very short, because Jarkissi is a notable case. But for those who don't know, there were three questions certified by the Supreme Court in Jarkissi. The first question certified was a jury trial question. I could rephrase it as essentially, can Congress take away constitutionally protected jury trial rights by expanding the jurisdiction of the SEC's in-house tribunals to encompass civil fraud prosecutions for penalties? Then there was a non-delegation claim in the case that the Supreme Court certified, and that focuses on the fact that the SEC has the choice whether to prosecute defendants in federal court or where, by the way, they have the full range of constitutional protections, including jury trial, or trying defendants before its own administrative law judges, where a host of constitutional and procedural protections are unavailable, especially jury trial. The Mr. Jarkissi had argued in the Fifth Circuit, and the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals agreed that by leaving this choice in the prosecuting agency's discretion, that was an unconstitutional delegation by Congress, and that Congress must decide for itself when and whether SEC defendants get jury trial rights and Article III court access, or it must at the very least provide the agency with an intelligible principle on which to make that decision, which the statute does not do. And finally, in the case, there was the issue that the SEC administrative law judges enjoy too many layers of tenure protection. In the case of the SEC ALJs, it's somewhere between two or three layers of tenure protection, depending on whether you think the commissioners themselves have tenure protection. But in any event, it's undebatable that there's at least two, and that the Free Enterprise Fund decision of 2010 had held that more than one layer of tenure protection violates the Constitution. A little factual background, George Jarkissi was charged with fraud in 2013. He went through an agonizing process going through the administrative law proceeding that I will spare all of you. But when he finally got to the promised judicial review, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals vacated the SEC's ALJ, as affirmed by the commission's decision against him, assessing a $300,000 penalty and barring him from the securities industry. And the Fifth Circuit had held in what was widely regarded as a landmark decision that his jury trial rights had been violated, that further the decision, leaving the decision of whether to prosecute him in a court as opposed to an administrative proceeding was an unconstitutional delegation of legislative power to the enforcement staff of the SEC. And finally, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals held that the removal protections that are enjoyed by the SEC ALJs violated the Take Care Clause. At oral argument, the jury trial question occupied virtually every aspect of the argument. In a moment, I will mention how the non-delegation issue ties into that, but the questioning and the argument, whether it was of the Solicitor General or of who was in the case was argued by Mr. Fletcher or of the respondent, the cases, the questions really focused on the jury trial question. So it is really kind of hard from that argument to reach any sense of how the court would handle two out of the three certified questions, since jury trial occupied the court's time. The atmosphere in the room, I thought, was very, it was a genuine attempt by the court to tackle this important jury trial question. I don't think any of the judges were treating it lightly or as a frivolous question. And they were really struggling with some of the line drawing. Sometimes the justices were trying to focus on the question of public and private rights, which proved to be difficult. In fact, Justice Thomas opened asking for definition of private rights. And we know from his decision in the Axon case that he felt strongly that where people are charged and their private rights are at stake, they should be in an Article III court. And I don't think he would back down from that position. I think that was it was very clear from the argument that would be consistently his view of things. Other justices were trying to focus on how and if a claim for fraud brought by the SEC against an individual maps onto what was common law fraud in 1791 and bringing claims for damages. And there was a lot of back and forth on that. The Solicitor General focused a lot on forum. And he came very close, I thought, to making an argument that I think was unwise, which was essentially if Congress assigns the claim to another forum, presumably an administrative tribunal, that decides the question. And I don't think the justices, even the ones who might not be inclined to affirm the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, were satisfied with that rather circular, simplistic, and self-serving definition of when you do and do not get a jury trial right. Justice Jackson was very active from the beginning, and she correctly, in my view, focused on the fact that the question is not the forum in which Congress assigns it, because it would be all too easy for Congress to simply take common law rights that where jury trial protections are expected to be afforded, and then just assign them to a different forum and then extinguish that right. I think she understood that that problem. And so she was focusing on what the nature of the cause of action was, which I think is the correct inquiry to make. I think she she's likely to perhaps come out on the other side of the question, but at least she's framing the issue, looking at the type of action that is being brought by the administrative agency as the correct thing to analyze as to whether there is a jury trial right. The arguments went on for some time. Each side got approximately an hour and 15 minutes. I don't think anyone felt shortchanged in the argument. And there was lively questioning right up front. Justice Gorsuch and the and Mr. Fletcher tangled on a few occasions, and that was kind of fun to see in terms of drawing distinctions. One thing that came out that I I think, qualifies my earlier statement that the argument focused pretty much completely on jury trial issues is that Justice Barrett in particular, but also Justice Kavanaugh in a somewhat different way, were very concerned with the ability of the SEC enforcement staff to essentially decide what quality and brand of justice that you got. And I do think that Mr. Jarkissi's counsel was effective in talking about the very well-known deficiencies of the administrative process in terms of hearsay and rules of evidence. He actually related the fact that in Mr. Jarkissi's own case, the SEC was successfully able to get hearsay admitted against Mr. Jarkissi. And then when they tried to admit hearsay, they were told that the administrative proceedings do not allow that sort of evidence, even though they were relying upon it themselves. And that's one of the troubling problems. Everything is asymmetrical. In the administrative proceedings, you are rushed into an early trial when the SEC has had years to investigate and build a record against you. You're given a document dump that's almost unmanageable and then expected to prepare your defense in mere weeks. And then you wait forever and ever for a decision from the agency. And I think the disparities of justice there were well set out, and I think of concern to at least some of the justices. And so when I say that the jury trial issue occupied virtually all of the argument, the non-delegation issue, which comes into play when the question is, well, can the prosecutor and enforcement staff make the unilateral decision of what brand of justice do you get? I think that was genuinely troubling several of the justices. And there were also some ardent defenses of the jury trial right and how important it was. The respondents did not ask for Atlas Roofing to be overturned, and that got raised at several points. For example, Justice Kagan seemed to feel that Atlas, at least in her questioning of respondents' counsel, Atlas pretty much decides the case. And I don't think that's true. The problem with Atlas is that's a government on one side of the V and a company on the other side of the V question. And the post-Atlas cases, which did constrain that ruling, the cases being Toll and Grand Financier and all that, were one private party versus another private party, where the question of denying them jury trial rights is a hard one. The government certainly was arguing when the government's on one side of the V, well, that sort of defines the issue. And I think that's a troubling argument for them to make, and I don't think the justices were necessarily buying that wholesale. And Respondents' Counsel was able to cite to an early case in 1790 called King versus, well, I'm forgetting the name of the person prosecuted for fraud, but it was the government bringing a fraud claim against an individual who had defrauded people. And is that a private right, or at least a claim for fraud, common law fraud, that where a jury trial right was recognized in 1790. And I think that is an effective rebuttal to the argument that was holding some force for at least part of the argument that, well, the post-Atlas Roofing case law really only applies between private parties. And when the government is on the other side of the V, it is sort of by definition a public right. I think the public private right issue was exposed in this argument as a deeply unsatisfactory way to resolve these questions. Justice Thomas asked the Solicitor General for a definition and got some pretty simplistic responses from the government. And I think the government was making arguments that were circular and I think not helpful to its case if you're really taking these questions seriously. I think one loser in the argument was this public-private rights distinction insofar as it bears on the jury trial question and how unsatisfactory that has been over the years. I suppose one question that might follow from that is it possible the court would overrule Atlas Roofing? I think that's unlikely because the respondent did not ask for it, and that came up a couple of times in the oral argument, and the court is certainly not going to be inclined to overrule a precedent of that long standing when that hasn't even been requested as part of the relief there. On the other hand, I think anything is possible, and there might be some justices who are flirting with that possibility. They might wait for a later case that presents that issue more cleanly to the court, but anything is possible. Certainly, I would say the court as a whole was wrestling very sincerely with the jury trial question, and I think they were concerned with the erosion of jury trial rights. Now, a contrary view did come up, and that was that, the world's got bigger, more complicated, and Congress has so many things on its mind, and it has, after one financial crisis or another, or one other, public emergency or another, Congress may decide that it needs to set up remedies for these situations that do not overburden the courts. And that did come up as a consideration that there are so many things that Congress needs to remedy that, we have to be careful we're not throwing too many claims into Article III courts and jury trials. I don't think that was an overriding concern of a majority of the justices, but it certainly was a subtext that had considerable play. I would call that the beginning of what I would call the floodgates issue. How is this going to play across many agencies? Are we opening up a flood of problems here where Congress will have to go back and look at agency adjudication schemes that it has set up in which jury trial rights are not permitted, and do they have to amend the statutes and all of that? And I think that was a hard and perhaps not even fair question to pose at argument, because of course that hasn't been briefed. And we know that these schemes differ from one agency to another. Some agencies actually allow people to elect to move their case back into court, which would certainly be a satisfactory solution. And that was mentioned at argument. But it's very difficult for any of the parties to effectively respond to that concern when that was not properly briefed. There was some mention of supplemental briefing in the discussion at argument that got a kind of dutiful response from the respondent. I doubt that will take place, but it does suggest that the court might decide to rule in a fairly narrow fashion so as not to implicate those concerns. I can't give you a nose count other than really from a very rough assessment. I think it is possible that the Fifth Circuit would be affirmed on one or more of the questions that were certified. I certainly don't think I came away from the argument feeling that the Fifth Circuit would be reversed, but it was not an overwhelming sense that the Fifth Circuit would be affirmed, and certainly not affirmed on all three questions. The question that got the least time was the removal questions. Now, that could be for a variety of reasons. It would be easy to say after attending argument today that the court will only decide the jury question because that's really all that was discussed at argument. And I think that's a fallacious conclusion to reach, and here's why. The court knows how to certify just one question if it wants to, and it certified all three and required briefing on all three. And it could equally be true that on the, for example, the removal question, which many people whom I've spoken with and who have reviewed the briefing or submitted amicus brief, many people think that the removal question is the easiest one. And so it is entirely possible that the court has already polled itself and that they feel that Free Enterprise Fund decides that question. Certainly, Justice Kagan felt that Free Enterprise Fund had decided the jurisdictional question in the Axon Cochran case. And as somebody who had briefed the Cochran case, I can tell you I had argued throughout those proceedings that Free Enterprise Fund not only decided the jurisdictional question, but the merits of whether more than one layer of tenure protection violates the Constitution. So it is entirely possible that the court has already reached a sort of a straw vote on that. And so there was no point in addressing that question at oral argument. As to the non-delegation argument, as I say, it arises and meshes with the jury trial argument because of the difficulty that several of the judges seem to have about when you do and do not have access to an Article III court, whether or not it gives you a jury trial. And I think that was troubling several of the justices. So I would not rule out the court reaching the non-delegation question, but it did not get a lot of distinctive argument on its own merits at the proceedings. The court seemed most concerned with dealing with Atlas Roofing, the Grand Financiera and toll decisions, and whether they did or did not effectively overrule Atlas Roofing. I think the line drawing, as I said earlier, but I will repeat, was kind of all over the place. Public, do you draw the line at the public-private distinction? Do you only award jury trial rights when there's a suit at common law? And one, I believe it was Justice Gorsuch pointed out that, of course, the dictionary definition of suit at the time the Seventh Amendment was adopted included a proceeding in any tribunal. And so I think that the suit distinction is an unsatisfactory one. It was certainly advanced by the Solicitor General, but I don't think it was a particularly persuasive distinction in which to decide the jury trial question. I said earlier that the idea that, if Congress simply puts you in a certain form, then you lose your jury trial rights. That didn't seem to carry a lot of persuasive weight. And I think the decision is probably going to turn on the right of action, which I think, the correct focus of the Seventh Amendment jury trial question, and whether or not this was something that was analogous enough to a common law right of action recognized in 1791, for which penalties could be sought. And there were some interesting hypotheticals offered by Justice Roberts up front. He said, well, you know, you have an interstate highway system. Could Congress say that at least on our roads, we want to put all tort claims into a non Article III court without juries? Same thing with healthcare. We regulate that heavily. Could we take medical malpractice claims, for example, and do the same thing? We want to move them into non-Article III courts with no juries and bring our expertise into deciding these, you know, tough questions of medical malpractice. And we have an interest as the government in reducing healthcare costs, for example. And so those were some very interesting hypotheticals that suggested to me that the chief was thinking carefully about the fact that this public rights, private rights distinction can be taken quite far. And, you know, pretty much everything becomes a public right if the government has any intersection with the issue at hand, and we could just extinguish all, you know, all claims that are supposed to be heard in courts and are supposed to be decided by juries. One thing I found disappointing was the provision in the Seventh Amendment, which focuses on the fact that jurors are supposed to be fact finders, didn't get a lot of play. That I think that's something that I wish had a little bit more development, because I think that when you have fact finding done by an administrative law judge who is employed by the very agency that is prosecuting you, and then you have, you know, eventual judicial review that defers to that fact finding, that's just such a troubling built-in structural bias that I wish that had gotten a little more development at oral argument, and it did not. But, you know, perhaps that's something the court understands so thoroughly that it didn't need a lot of questioning on that. I think that's a pretty description of the general things that were addressed at oral argument. The general atmosphere in the courtroom, I think, was one of sincere engagement. You could see colloquies going back between the justices. Very often one justice would take up another justice's line of questioning. Justice Sotomayor actually asked the Solicitor General to please answer the chief's question. And there were back and forths with the, you could see between Justice Barrett and Justice Jackson on some of these very tough line drawing questions. So I think, you know, in terms of a more general concern about whether the court is, you know, has retreated into factions, I think what you saw was a very sincere engagement with some very hard questions, as to which the justices, all of them, care deeply.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. SCOTUSCast is a project of the Federalist Society, a not-for-profit educational organization of conservative and libertarian law students, law professors, and lawyers. Founded upon the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental power is essential to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast series, including SCOTUSCast and Practice Group Podcasts, on iTunes or Google Play. For an archive of past podcasts, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at fedsoc.org/multimedia. That's fedsoc.org/multimedia.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.